3. This is an interview for the Brickmakers Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is August 30th, 2007, and I'm at the home of Ray Baraby, and this is Andrea Lungju. Could you start just by giving me your full name and spelling it?
Raymond C. Baraby, B-E-R-U-B-E.
And when were you born?
June 22nd, 1937.
And where were you born?
Danville, Maine.
Did you grow up in Danville?
I was there probably till the age of 2, and then we moved to New Orleans on the corner of 3rd and Mary Carroll.
And so that's where you really grew up in the neighborhood?
I grew up there until the age of 11. I went to St. Louis School. Then we moved to Old Auburn near the Old Auburn Police Station on School Street. Mm-hmm. I went to school at Chamberlain School, and then I went to school at Webster and the Old Edward Little.
And what were your parents' names?
Blanche Baraby and Leon Baraby. They both worked in Bates Mill all their lives.
They did. Well, now, what did they do in the Bates Mill?
My father was a machinist, and my mother, I forget over the years just exactly what her job was, but I know it was lifting over her head, something that she lifted over her head and put on hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And she came here from Canada when she was a young child. And they were actually, her entire family of about 14, grew up in Danville on a farm. They lived off the farm.
Oh, wow.
So.
What was your mother's maiden name?
Dionne.
Dionne.
She was supposedly related somehow to the Dionne quintuplets.
Wow.
So, I've never researched the family background, but that's what I was told by my cousin who did.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had two brothers and 4 sisters. The eldest of the family was a boy, Richard. He died at 9 years of age of leukemia. In fact, he died the same year I was born.
Yeah.
So I never got to know him.
Yeah. Now, growing up in the New Auburn area and the other areas of Auburn, you got a sense of the different communities. What was it like to grow up during?
New Auburn was very, very French-Canadian. If you walked around the streets of New Auburn when I was a child, you would not hear anyone speaking English.
Yeah.
It was a French-speaking community, the same as Lewiston. New Auburn was the same as Lewiston, and actually separated from Old Auburn. Old Auburn and New Auburn were like 2 totally different communities. Because of the Yankees in Old Auburn and the French speaking in New Auburn.
Yeah.
In fact, when I moved to Old Auburn, it was rough in the beginning because there weren't that many Canadians over there, and we spoke real broken English, so you had a hard time to cope until you made a few friends.
Yeah.
But eventually, Shasta, behave. It's a lot worse than the kids.
Now, what brought you to brickmaking? At what age were you introduced to that?
I would have to say around 12 or 13 years old. I was taught a real value insofar as working for a living, and we started really young. I had a paper out at around 10 or 11 years of age, and then I don't remember how I really got introduced to the brickyard. I know my father used to burn bricks from Orrin Brickyard. And I heard stories from him and my uncles who also worked in Orrin Brickyard making brick. And when I first went to Dennis, which was closer to where I was living at the time, I was living on Washington Street, southbound, which was First Avenue at the time. There was no turnpike or Interstate 95 or anything else. And I remember going down there, and I wanted a job, and I weighed about 80 pounds soaking wet. So I was really wasn't big enough or strong enough to do the type of work that they did. So when I started by sanding brick. We had a little sandbox with a handle on it. And when the brick makers made the brick, they laid them out on the yards. and they had to be sanded from so that the sun would not dry them too fast or they would crack. And that's what I first started doing when I first went to the brickyard.
Now that was at like age 12 or 13.
Yeah.
So how often did you work during a week, say?
In the very beginning it was probably 3 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
And then as I grew older, I started learning the intricacies of the brickmaking business, because I still wasn't big enough or strong enough to do the wheeling of the wheelbarrows and setting kills and everything else.
Yeah.
So I learned from the bottom up how they made the benches, what you did to make the benches, the difference in the brick, how you started all the way to the top of the benches, and then your kills were built on top of your benches after your benches were done. And Lawrence, the oldest of the brothers, there were four Dennis brothers, showed me how to burn. I was only around 14 or 15 years of age,
yeah,
and I was burning the brick, actually supposedly a head burner, and I had men that were doing the actual heavy work.
Right.
And when you burn the brick, when you first started, you had wood that you had put in between the benches, and you had an opening from one side of the kiln to the other. The kiln was probably 30 feet wide.
Mm.
So when you first started the kilns after they were built, you started by burning that wood inside. And that probably took maybe 12 to 14 hours. But as you burned the brick, you had to slowly, in the beginning, dry the brick. So you had to fire it, then let it cool off so that the smoke and the steam could go out through the top. If you actually tried to burn it too fast in the beginning, with the soot and everything, you could actually totally plug up a kiln so that you wouldn't be able to burn it. You have to be very careful.
Yeah.
Because otherwise than that, you would have had to rebuild an entirely new kiln and take that brick and transfer it all to a new kiln. It was quite something back then. It took 14 days and 14 nights continually to burn brick, nonstop.
And then would you have to build another kiln?
You would build a kiln every time you made new brick.
Okay.
The brick making, the brick burning itself was started from the ground up. You're the one that actually built the kiln.
Right.
Today it's all automated. They have kilns that they can actually put brick into, and it's almost like making bread. They have belts where the bricks go in and go through a cycle of heating and cooling off, the same as the way you make bread today.
And which, I know there are different kinds of bricks. What kind did you make at Dennis?
They made both water struck and wire cut. Marin and Danville only made the water struck. They had a secondary brickyard in Westbrook that made the wire cut. The wire cut was a lot easier to make than a water struck. The water struck was made 100% manually, and it had to be laid on a yard to dry. And then it had to be hicked, then it had to be put in rows to dry, and it was a really long process. The wire cut actually came out of the machine in the form of a brick. And if you hit a pallet, you cut it with wires, with a handle that would swing back and forth. Then you take the pallets, put it on the wheelbarrows, and wheel them into the racks. You had long racks, probably numbering 100, with shelves. You would actually put the pallets on shelves, maybe 10 or 12 high,
yep,
where they would dry. Then after they dry, then that's what you do. Your next step, after they would dry, after your benches were made, you'd start putting your brick up and making a kiln. You'd have normally two guys at the top setting the brick that were actually building the kiln, and maybe three wheelers that were constantly putting bricks on the belts.
Hmm.
And it was all for 14 days, 14 nights, all done by wood. And you fire from one side of your kiln, close the doors, put mud around the doors so they were airtight. Then you'd go on the other side and fire from the other side. And you kept switching every day from side to side, so that your kills would burn evenly. And you had, it's I would have probably been better off writing this down so I could have gone step by step through the process, but as I'm speaking, I'm remembering some of the things we did. Like at the very beginning, you had a row of bricks that you put on the top, which you spaced in order to let the soot and the steam and everything else come out through. Once this process was done, you had to climb up on top of the kiln. It probably took 3-4 days, if I remember right. And you'd go up there with bars and you'd put wooden shoes on your feet because you had fired that for 4 or 5 days. Now it's getting warm. Well, you'd have to go up there and close all the spaces so that you'd be able to keep that much more heat inside your kiln. So you'd probably be 2 or 3 guys up there, and you had to bring brick up with you so that as you're closing these spaces, you're tightening them up, you're needing more brick. So it was a very, very warm job. As a matter of fact, the wood that was on your feet would sometimes catch on fire.
Yeah.
And you'd have to throw it off to the side and go on the side and pick up another pair. And it was a hot job. Now, I think it was very difficult to get people who would do that today.
Yeah.
Because especially when your kilns got real hot and you were taking off these doors, the heat was completely unbearable. You would wear long johns in summer, the heat, that 75, 80 degree heat, you would wear long johns, a pair of long pants, and a leather apron to keep it from burning your leg. Mm. That's how much heat was coming out of that. In fact, you'd have some brick makers who were really heroes, and we're going to show how tough they were. I remember one particular guy, I think his name was Andy Bergeron. And he was making brick like a total water strut where they used to do that in the bathing suit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was going to show how tough he was and actually push the wood in there with the bathing suit. And he did, and he was out of work probably for a couple, 3 weeks after that because his leg was all blistered from the heat from the kiln. But he did it. He was tough. But I mean, they did a lot of foolish things like that. And most brick makers, or I should say, probably a good percentage of them were very heavy drinkers. When I first started sanding as a young man of 12, 13 years old, there was a gentleman and his son. Well, I won't say what their names were, but they used to come to work in the morning with a case of Schmidt's ale, 24-ounce bottles, quarts. By the time they left that morning to go home while the brick was drying, the case of beer was gone. And when they came back in the afternoon, they had another case of beer. And when they finished their work in the afternoon, that was gone. So there were definitely some tough customers that worked in the brickyards. They had to be because the work was grueling. They worked in the brickyards in the summer, and the majority of them worked in the woods in the wintertime, cutting wood.
Well, talking about wood, was it difficult to keep a good wood supply on site?
No, you had, I don't know if it was lumber companies or who was piling it, but we used to go out in Litchfield, out in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
They had piles and piles and piles, as far as the eye could see, of what we call slabs. It was the outer pieces of you're in a sawmill, you're cutting the outer strips in order to get your 2x4s, boards and everything else. That would be piled out in Litchfield, and we used to haul it all day long in trucks.
Wow.
And we'd have some piled in the brickyard, way ahead before we even started burning. But as soon as we started burning, we started hauling wood at the same time. There was never a shortage of wood.
Now, did your job change as you got older? How long were you there working at the brickyard?
Oh, I'd say all the way through high school. And probably a year or so after high school.
Did you go full time during those summer months?
Oh yeah.
When you got older?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was in high school in the summertime when we were burning, myself and two other guys had worked. You could work as many hours as you wanted. There was no time and a half for one thing. There was no overtime. There were no benefits. There was absolutely nothing. At the time, we were making $1 an hour. We worked 132 hours one week. And as a matter of fact, I remember bringing that paycheck home, and my paycheck was more than my mother and father's paycheck together in Bates Mill. So, you know, people complain about what they make today. They should have worked in the mills and shoe shops. Like I said, the shoe shops, they probably made a little more money than they did in the mills.
Yeah.
And the mills were really, really bad. When you talk about slaves in the South, we have slaves here in Maine. Big time. The French Canadians built the city of Lewiston on nothing. I mean, these people made absolutely nothing. I find it hard to believe that, you know, St. Joseph, St. Mary's, St. Peter and Paul Basilica, St. Patrick's, these places were all built with the money that people made back then. Because I know I grew up back then, and we had plenty to eat in the house, but I never saw any steak. And I never saw lobster, and in fact, I didn't even know what steak was. We had hot dogs, we had hamburgers, macaroni, Chinese pie. You didn't eat the way your kids do today.
Right.
Kids don't know how well off they are. I mean, you can't hire somebody for $10 an hour to dig a ditch.
Yeah.
You know? Even my grandchildren, when I was doing a roof, one of them was 18, I think the other one was 70. They wanted $100 to work for the day, helping me on a roof. They have absolutely no value of money.
Yeah.
None. It's unbelievable. Well, that's why the credit cards today max to the to the hills, and these kids are going to have what they want even if they have to put it on credit cards.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is something that children today just, they have no work ethic. It's gone by the wayside.
Now, can you talk about any brickmakers that you worked with? I know you mentioned a couple stories, but were there any ones that had been there a long time, or did they come and go? What was the sort of the feeling of the workers in the brickyards?
It was mostly the same crews, the same, especially the ones making the water-struck brick.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real art. I mean, not everyone could do this. When they took the brick out of the machine and put it on the wheelbarrows, they had like a mold with a board underneath the mold. When they put that brick on the yard, it had to be in one swift motion. That brick had to come off the wheelbarrow. It had to be turned upside down just before it hit the ground, and it had to be done very softly so that when you took your board off, your brick wouldn't just splatter all over the yard. It had to retain its mold. And that had to weigh, God, it had to be between 40 and 50 pounds.
Yeah.
And they did that hours on end. Most of them were very, very big boys. And like I said, it was an art taking the bricks off the wheelbarrows, because not everybody could do it. A lot of people tried, and you'd end up just dropping your bricks on the ground and having to pick them back up and throw them back in the back of the machine.
Right.
So that most of them were, like I say, worked with the same men over and over again. Harvey the Grosier did it for years.
I interviewed him.
Yeah, Rachel's husband.
Yeah.
And he was one of the best, one of the very, very best. He was fast. And there were two of them that would wheel from the front, and one would generally shovel in a pit. And if one was faster than the other and they didn't get along, then somebody was going to run all that. And I mean, that would happen a lot, where the better man took advantage of his position and could really do it fast. So he was actually back up at the machine before the guy had finished loading his wheelbarrow. So he had time to rest a little bit. The other guy had to constantly move just to keep up. But yeah, it was mostly the same guys, summer after summer after summer, until eventually you could see where it was getting harder and harder to get people, because where they could rotate, three guys that could do the job well could rotate, and the one that was shoveling in the pit, you could actually rest. But if you didn't have three guys that could do the wheeling in the front, then one guy stayed in the pit. The two guys in the front had to find somebody just to shovel the mud out. So they never got a break. Towards the end, mostly it was two guys in front that were doing all the work without any breaks.
Yeah.
So it was tough. Yeah. It was really, really a tough business.
And now, and then you went on to something else after.
I never really, I shoveled a pit a few times, but yeah. I could never get the trick of flipping those bricks onto the ground
yeah.
without damaging them. You know, I mean, you could do it maybe a half a dozen times, but then if you plop three of them down, it just yeah. wasn't worth it. I mean, you know, the other guy that could do it, you'd just be holding them up. But, I mean, because...
All right, and so you were saying...
So I never really... I did some wheeling and a little bit of shoveling in a pit for brickmakers, but because I was never that big, I learned the intricacies of the brickmaking business so that I was building walls, making the benches, doing everything that the bosses would be doing.
Right.
And you know, I was doing the burning when they would burn kilns at night. I worked with a couple of their sons, burning brick, and I learned from bottom to top the brick making business because I was too small to do anything else.
Now, is there anything I haven't asked you about brick making that you think is important to add?
You don't get your coloration in your brick today the way we did back then, because your coloration in the brick came from your wood. Your oil, you just get a flat color.
Yeah.
You're not getting the real pretty colors like you did back then. When they first started burning with oil, you would still burn with wood at the end for 3 or 4 days that would give you that coloration in the brick. Yeah. Now they don't do that anymore. Like it took 14 days and 14 nights. Now I think they do it probably even half the time, if not less.
Yeah.
Because it's a more even temperature.
Right.
I mean, the temperature was really warm, but it would vary quite a bit.
Yeah.
Doing this by eye, watching the top of the kiln. It was all done by whoever was burning. You had to really watch and see what you were doing and how hot the kiln was on both sides.
Right.
Actually, just to show sometimes how hot it was in there, we would take an empty bottle and push it in there, and it would totally melt. You know, a real thick, what was at the time real thick Coke bottles, or soda bottles.
Or beer bottles.
Beer bottles, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how warm it was. I don't know exactly what the degree is to melt glass, but it's quite a bit.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh great.
I can probably show you here.
Okay, thank you.
I'd actually have to write it down from the very beginning where the different steps were. You know, like you build a kiln, then you had to put an outside layer on the kiln, then you'd mud the kiln, like you see an adobe or something, and sand and water. Then on both ends, you had to build another layer of brick on edge, and you left a space in between which you filled with sand.
Okay.
You know, you did everything you could to keep as much heat in there as possible. So it was quite a thing. I really liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Did you see when, I mean, they've automated it today, but those old brickyards doing it manually, do you know, when did they start to fade out? Do you know?
I'd say probably LaChance, if I remember right, LaChance in Westbrook had what they call a beehive, even back then, where I never get the chance to look at it, but I think they would put the brick inside, and the kiln would stay there. I think it must have been probably late 70s or early 80s where they really started automating things.
Yeah. Great, thank you. Is there anything else?
Not that I can think of. I'll think of it after you're gone.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Okay.